And we're continuing today with our series on Earth Consciousness and Lore of the Amazon, a symposium presented by Synergetic Press south of Santa Fe. And I'm delighted to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Alan Bediner. He's an activist and writer. He's a contributing editor to Tricycle Magazine. He's the editor of the new edition of Zigzag Zen, Buddhism and Psychedelics, published by Synergetic Press. He's on the board of the CBD Project. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Don Lattin is an author and journalist. His books include The Harvard Psychedelic Club and Distilled Spirits. His forthcoming book is Changing Our Minds, The Reemergence of Psychedelics for Mental Health and Spiritual Growth. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Ralph Metzner joins us. He is a psychologist, writer, founder of the Green Earth Foundation, author of many books, including Allies for Awakening and Green Psychology. Welcome.
Thank you.
So we are talking about a kind of a category that includes psychedelics, human consciousness, and the social implications of these courses of study that people have been doing, study, recreation, all kinds of ways of experiencing these things. And I wondered if maybe each of you could talk about how you yourself got on this path.
Well, I got on it because I'm a research psychologist, and you know, I was involved in that study with project at Harvard in the 60s, and then over time I became interested in other aspects of consciousness study, including shamanism and meditation and so forth.
Tell us about the project at Harvard in the 60s, which some of our listeners probably don't know about.
Well, there were several main projects, but one of them was that became very well known, was involved giving psilocybin, which is the synthetic insert of the magic mushroom, to convicted prisoners in a state correctional facility to see if having an insight experience would help them stay out of jail, change their ways, stay out of jail, reduce the recidivism rate. We were never able to prove that it reduced the recidivism rate, because to do that you have to have a support system for people once they get out of jail. But we did, you know, produce insight experiences and learned a lot. And it was, because interesting, what was became clear, and what was, this was Leary's influence, that to study these kinds of drugs would change your mind, would change your consciousness. You can't just give in to people and observe their behavior, because there's no behavior to observe. The person is, everything that's interesting is happening inside their own mind. So the only way to study it is just to take it yourself and record with others and record what it is that you're seeing. Describe it. And so then we did another study, a major study that was actually a double-blind placebo-controlled study of religious experience that was done by Walter Pankey, who was a had a theology degree and an MD degree. And we set up the set and the setting. That was the idea of the set and the setting. It was a religious ceremony, an Easter Sunday ceremony in a church in an underground during the ceremony, and the people were all theology students. So they were all primed to have a religious experience. And they did. And we had a double-blind placebo-controlled model showing that, you know, the group that had the psilocybin had significantly religious experiences. So those are two of the primary research studies that emerged out of the 60s. But then, of course, everything became illegal, and the main focus of activity went underground. Not that people stopped taking drugs, but they stopped talking about
it. What did you do during that period?
Well, I explored all kinds of, you know, explorations of consciousness, other methods, shamanism, shamanic journey methods, meditation methods, and I continued to teach. I was professor at the California Institute of San Francisco for 35 years, teaching courses in consciousness and like that.
Well,
Alan Bediner.
I think I can say with some certainty I was a straight-edge person. I wasn't even drinking coffee. This is now in college, and before that, for sure.
The 1960s.
Yes. But I was a political activist, mainly around the Vietnam War, with a group called SDS. But I was not attracted to any mind-altering substances, from cigarettes to LSD, although my roommates were on LSD more often than not. But that wasn't my path, and I just, I was quite happy without it. But then I went to India, And in traveling in India, I became intoxicated by Indian spirituality. Maybe perhaps too intoxicated, not in this literal sense, but just, you know, sort of losing track of my real world and adopting a new one. And a friend said, look, before you go back to the States, you should meditate. You should go someplace and, you know, get it all together so you can absorb and integrate. And I did. I took her advice. I went to a Buddhist monastery in Sri Lanka. And I sat for basically almost 3 weeks in silence.
That's a long time.
Long time. It was very uncomfortable, miserable experience. Stewed greens at 6 in the morning for breakfast, the same stewed greens for lunch and no dinner. And the bed was like cement. There were flies. It was not clean. It was just a mess. And I was miserable. Every bone in my body ached. But to make a long story short, 2 days before this retreat was over, it all fell away. And I felt incredible. And I had this amazing experience of connection with everything around me, including the bugs that I was so offended by. And I just, it was just a total remarkable experience, quiet state of ecstasy. And so that started me on a quest to find out what happened to me and what was that. So I started studying Buddhism. At the same time, I took a job at the LA Weekly, which is a LA free publication, but was quite influential at the time. I had, my beat was the mystical stuff, the head stuff, from Thich Nhat Hanh to psychoneuroimmunology, et cetera, et cetera. Ralph Metzner. So I was investigating it as a sort of career thing, but also as a personal thing. And I started talking to Terence McKenna about doing a story about him. And he convinced me that I should get off it and try something. So I explored psilocybin.
Now, that was the first time you'd explored any, like, ingesting a drug.
It was, and actually, that it wasn't actually the first time. The first time was a party when I first got back from India, where a friend slapped some powder on my tongue, and I trusted she knew that I wasn't into drugs. She said, "Don't worry about it, just have a good time." And I had an extraordinary time. It turned out it was MDMA. And I turned to someone who I didn't care about or didn't care for and had a wonderful conversation. I mean, I almost said, you know, let's get married. But I didn't. And that's a sort of a classic story about people taking MDMA and getting carried away. So that was a very interesting experience. So that opened the door, but I still was not looking for more. Terence convinced me to do psilocybin, which I did a couple of times, and then to do, which was more than 25 years ago, something that most people didn't know anything about. It was called Yahe. It's now called ayahuasca. And Terence was an early shaman where he had learned to make it in the native way. And so that was another example, a horrible experience, a full-blown shamanic death journey, very uncomfortable, very unpleasant, but which I am so grateful for and serves me every day, even now.
And you wrote about that in some detail in the book Zigzag Zen.
Exactly.
And I think one of the things that was so striking to me about that story that you wrote is that, I mean, a lot of people do, and I think one of the reasons drugs are so controversial is because even drugs that are not toxic or addictive or really don't hurt anybody, even the person who's doing them, but they seem to be just the essence of a kind of self-indulgent trip. Like, you're just doing this to have an experience, and you come down and you just go on with your life with maybe your mind a little bit duller or maybe not. But what you experienced and what you wrote about is that death experience that you had of seeing your own body stayed with you for the rest of your life and actually changed you as a person.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, in many ways. I mean, I have more appreciation for the magic and the beauty and the miracle that life is. And I have less fear of death because I kind of died and already had the experience. So it's a little less frightening. I'm not saying that I'm not afraid of death in any way, because that probably wouldn't be true. But it definitely has a lessening of the fear around it. And more appreciation for life and less fear of death, which can go a long way.
Don Lattin, you are a journalist, you're an author. How did you start this whole trajectory of interest in these ideas and substances?
Well, like many people who came of age in the 1960s and 1970s, I experimented with psychedelic drugs, including LSD, you know, in college in the early 70s, even before that in high school. And I had some revelatory experiences where I, mystical experiences that just blew me away, feeling at one with everything in the universe and having a connection with another person that was just extraordinary. It felt like love for the first time. I was a 19-year-old kid, very naive. I didn't know what was going on. And then shortly after that, I had a horrendous trip, the bad trip from Central Casting, and had a bit of a little psychotic break for a month or so after that, and had a very difficult time. So from the very beginning, I appreciated that these drugs are, like Aldous Huxley says, they're heaven and hell. You can experience both, especially LSD. It's such a powerful drug, especially if you don't know what you're doing and you don't have the right set and setting, which at the time I didn't. So I had a, from very early in my life, I'm in my 60s now, I've had a real appreciation and also a fear and respect of these substances because of my personal experiences. And then later on in the 80s, or the late 70s actually, mid-70s, I explored MDA, which is a little different than MDMA, with a group of people, and had another extraordinary kind of experience, feeling empathy, enjoying compassion like I'd never felt before. And what was interesting about that, and then later with MDMA, which is a similar compound in some ways, these are people who became my best friends for the rest of my life. We had some drug experiences, sure, but we had a bond that continued for the rest of our life. And two of these people just died recently, and my best friends. And I was younger than some of these people in this crowd back then. And to me, that shows the value of these, because we didn't keep taking this drug, but it created a bond, a friendship, a love that lasted for our entire life. So I really respect these substances. Professionally, I've been a newspaper reporter for most of my life, and a journalist, and the author of about 5 books, several on the history of psychedelic drugs. And I was the religion writer at the San Francisco Chronicle for many years. And one of the reasons I got interested in religion, broadly defined, spirituality, religion, mysticism, is because of my experiences I had on psychedelic drugs. I mean, I wound up covering everything from the Pope to people in the psychedelic therapy movement or whatever, but it was one of the reasons I chose to write about religion and spirituality as a journalist. And the book I just finished for Synergetic Press here in Santa Fe, which we just decided on the title, it's just Changing Our Minds, The Reemergence of Psychedelics for Mental Health and Spiritual Growth, is what's happening right now in this research. Right now, all the cutting-edge research that's going on, above-ground, government-approved research using MDMA and psilocybin to treat people and to really help people with PTSD, with depression and anxiety because of a cancer diagnosis, people with addiction, people suffering from autism, young adults with autism who have social anxiety over that. So I've been really enjoying this research in the last few years, and I also dipped my toe back into personally trying these drugs in the context that they're being used, in the setting they're being used now. So with a therapist, with blindfolds and headphones, also writing about ayahuasca in this book for a couple chapters, and I went to Brazil. I've been with some underground shamanic circles in Northern California. So I'm trying to experience this myself, but the book is not so much about me. It's about what other people are doing. But as a participant observer, I really need to get a sense of how these drugs are being used in this context, because that's so important. The context is so important.
Yeah, let's talk about context.
Leary became known in the literature as formulating this idea of the importance of the set and the setting. To understand a psychedelic experience, you have to understand the set and the setting. It's not just a matter of taking a drug, because people can take that same drug and do something completely different with it, including some things that are not so good, or it could be dangerous. So the set is basically the intention, why are you doing it? Doing it for therapy or just for fun. And the setting is the kind of setting that we had, and who else is there, what kind of music is playing, and like that. I now think that, and that formula has been generally accepted by all the researchers in the field. Now, if you do a research study, of course, the set and setting is given by the research study. But if you're if you're taking the drug and going to a rave, then that's a completely different setting. So the results are not really comparable. In order to get comparable scientific results, you have to have control of these variables. So I now actually say that of those two set and setting, the set is the most important, because the set or the intention determines what kind of setting you're going to choose.
Mindset,
intention, yes, attitude. If you're a couple and they're doing couples therapy with MDMA and a therapy, then you have that intention for healing, and MDMA is used as an amplifier of interaction and couples interaction or relationship, and then the setting would be the therapist's office and like that, and a whole series of rituals. If you're a young person wanting to drop MDMA or what do they call it, ecstasy, and go to a dance, it's a completely different set and setting, maybe the same drug. They're not interested in doing internal therapy. They're doing just interested in having a good time. It's a kind of an amphetamine-like stimulant. There was actually a Hollywood movie called The Anniversary Party. I don't know if you ever saw that. It was very interesting. A group of sort of wealthy, middle-class professionals gather at somebody's birthday party, and then Gwyneth Paltrow plays the role of a woman who comes and gives ecstasy to everybody without telling them what it is, actually. But they all say, oh, yeah, it's Gwyneth, it's great. Or maybe she does tell them. And so gradually, the whole party sort of becomes much more deeper, and people start talking to each other and revealing deep things about their lives and their aims and their families and their sorrows, and in a very loving, interesting way, very slow, see. So a typical ecstasy assembly, I mean, they're the kinds where you go and dance, but then there are others where a small group of people will just lie around or sit around and talk closely to each other, maybe hold hands every now and again. Not sexual. It's an interesting thing. Sexual is actually lowers sexual drive. And this is one of the reasons why women like it a lot, because they feel safe in a large gathering. Women can take ecstasy in a large gathering, in these large rave parties, for example, with 2,000 people. They don't get hit on. People don't want to have sex. They just want to cuddle and pat each other and talk closely. And
right, right. Well, and it seems like there's a couple things. One is that people who might be doing something for, as you say, just to have a good time, might find themselves inadvertently in what ends up being a therapeutic or life-opening situation, it sounds
like.
Yeah,
that can happen. But it's less likely to happen with MDMA. MDMA is unique among other psychedelic drugs that way, because it doesn't, it doesn't really produce any visual effects. It just produces a kind of a heart opening. Like a client of mine, and he reported his first experience with it. This is 20 years ago when it first became known. He already experienced LSD and various other drugs. He took this MDMA and he said, well, this is interesting. Everything looks just the same, but I feel completely differently about it. Which is unlike psychedelics. Everything does not look the same.
Right.
Yeah. That's the classic psychedelic vision, is like the chair is melting and the walls are rippling and the flowers are spraying with whatever. So, but that's why I think MDMA is actually by far the most useful drug for therapy. Because when somebody has PTSD, for example, or life-threatening anxiety, the last thing you want to do is give them more elaborate visual hallucinations. They want to have the ability to tune into your heart center and a kind of compassion for themselves and for others. Compassion for themselves. And couples who take it together or take it separately, working on their issue, have the feeling that they can share things that they otherwise would be difficult to share with their partner.
And that lasts beyond the effect of...
Yes, that's the other thing. It lasts beyond. I know many people, myself included, who are not particularly interested in taking MDMA. So nothing really happens. I would take it if I had something to... if I could, let's say, if I had something to work out with a friend or with a partner or whatever. But other than that, there's no reason. The other psychedelics are much more interesting.
Some of the research subject that I interviewed for the book I'm doing for Synergetic Press are Marines who've come back from Afghanistan and Iraq, with horrible stories and with PTSD from the trauma that they went through. And one guy who's in the first chapter of my book, he accidentally gunned down two little girls who were in a truck. He thought it was a truck with an explosive device coming at him, and he saw their bodies, and the driver of the truck, the father, wasn't killed, and he saw the father carrying these children away, their bodies away through the desert, and he had other horrendous experiences of fellow soldiers who died, and he struggled for years when he got back with this, and he was misdiagnosed by the VA. There was actually a cover-up to try to discount the number of vets who were suffering from this during the Bush administration especially. But anyway, he was one of the subjects in a study sponsored by MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies in South Carolina, the PTSD study, and he was really helped in it. I mean, because it was this fear. PTSD, a lot of it is fear. The fearful memories or the hard memories, they're not filed away in the right part of your brain. And with the therapy and the MDMA, he was able to really look at this again and really find healing from that trauma. And I've talked to several people in that situation, vets who were really helped with this therapy.
Yeah, and it's not temporary. It can be considered as close as you could to a cure.
It can be, but it depends on the follow-up. It really does. I mean, another vet that I interviewed went down to Peru and went to a retreat center and did ayahuasca with a shaman. And when I interviewed him, he had another amazing story of recovery. It was a very different experience than MDMA, more of a classic psychedelic experience. But he came back, and when I interviewed him, he was great. He had stopped, he had been drinking and drugging. His life had fallen apart. He couldn't keep in a relationship. He was talking about how wonderful this experience in Peru was. And 6 months later, he was back where he was. He because he didn't have any follow-up. He didn't have any way to integrate that experience into
his... Well, that was ayahuasca.
That was ayahuasca, yeah, in Peru. That's why I think the importance of being in a therapeutic relationship, having a follow-up and having a way to take these whatever insights you have back into your life is important.
Yeah, I would actually say there's an underground network of, it's international, of therapists and people that use these substances in a serious way. I mean, not serious, not in the fun that they can't have fun or laughter as well, but with the intention of healing and therapy and growth and self-understanding and spiritual practice. So that's a kind of a separate audience from the people who basically just take it recreational. Not there's anything wrong with recreational, but when you don't have any particular intention other than just to have fun and dance, which is okay, you know, as long as it doesn't hurt anybody, why should we bother about it? But there's an underground movement of people who are sincerely kind of seekers, you could say seekers. They are often in therapy or practitioners of therapy themselves. They have a serious interest in spiritual practices of one kind or another, whether it's Buddhist or shamanic. And they have an interest in many different cultural forms and forms of artistic expression. So that's a cultural phenomenon, that this is a drug that's been made illegal, that has been proven to have fantastic value, therapeutic value under certain circumstances for certain conditions, and that basically you can't get, except in the context of a formalized research project sponsored at a university or a clinical setting like that, which costs a huge amount of money and does not really address anything like the needs of the treatments of trauma that's actually needed, considering 6 veterans a day are committing suicide.
Yeah, and lots of other people are committing suicide, and lots of other people are experiencing incredible amounts of anxiety. There are so many women who are not even, when you think about PTSD, there are so many women who are rape survivors who are walking around for their whole lives with a kind of PTSD who don't really have access to the kinds of things that you're talking about, because most people are not part of some controlled study sponsored by an institute. So they basically have to, what do? Buy it on the street?
Well,
nobody
is,
wants to do that.
It is an underground, and the underground does not mean just buying on the street. It's an underground. It's very large. The number of people who actually take MDMA, I would say, internationally, is in the millions. There's at least 10 times, at least 100 times as much than to take it in controlled studies. It's under, and underground does not mean counterculture. These are not people that are opposed to the mainstream culture. These are people that are in the mainstream culture, but they do not want to go to jail for the use of substances which are not, they're not experiencing as being harmful, and they're not harming themselves or anybody else.
So people have these underground laboratories.
People have laboratories. There are producers of underground things. There are networks, and it's based on trust.
But the goal of the government-approved above-ground clinical studies, as small as they are, the ultimate goal is to reclassify this drug so it can be used openly and legally by more people. That's the whole
right.
idea. And one of the two organizations that's promoting this, which is MAPS, says that they're very clear that they see this medicalization of MDMA as one step towards legalization. There's another organization called the Hefter Research Institute. They're a little more cautious about that. They're just interested in the science and the therapy. But that's the goal. The goal is to make these substances, these healing medicines, more available to people in a legal way.
The MDMA studies that, from what I understand, is that the difference really is enormous between taking MDMA alone by yourself or with friends in some context that's casual, and taking it with a therapist, with a trained therapist, who can really maximize the kind of transformation that it offers in terms of opening your heart and seeing things differently, et cetera. So that's the magical part of the thing as well.
Right.
And that relates to some of the projects that, you know, that CIS, this Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco, is now trying, where they've got established a 9-month training program for therapists that want to use MDMA and other substances. And what are the kinds of things you need to do, and how do the therapists need to be prepared and trained and so forth. The training program does not involve the taking of any drug, because all the drugs are illegal.
Right.
And maybe they will be not be at some other point, but there's enough to learn about how to use these drugs and how to work with them, mm-hmm. and the chemistry beside and the physiology and the safety precautions that you need to have, that it's a program, and it's attracted, you know, in its first go-round, it's a year, it's a 9-month long intensive training program. So
a lot of the drugs that we're talking about either are or are derived from plant substances that have been used in shamanistic settings from the beginning of time. You know, we have, I don't know what kind of evidence, I think you guys can probably speak to that in some detail, but I think what's so interesting about this is that, I mean, we co-evolved with these plants as tribal people, as hunter-gatherers, presumably, probably before that too. We learned to take them. There were all kinds of sets and settings. They were probably associated with various kinds of vision quests, maybe coming of age rituals. And, I mean, here's the thing. People who take them have mystical experiences, or what we call religious experiences or spiritual experiences, which is now being studied as a brain thing. And we're probably going to at some point understand exactly what's happening in what parts of our brain and what these things mean physiologically. But, I mean, the fact that we can be stimulated in this manner and now in a somewhat controlled scientific setting and have what we can only call spiritual or mystical or religious experiences means that our brains are wired to do that and have evolved to do that. And I wanted to see if you could help us to understand, like, what does that mean? What is the significance of the fact that our brains can go to those places and see those visions and experience connection in that way? I mean, is it part of our adaptive evolutionary biological heritage?
Well, that's the underlying assumption of evolutionary theory. They evolved. These practices evolved. And these mind drugs, they enhance perception. They enhance perception. They enhance your ability to perceive and to feel emotionally connected to life around you, plant life, animal life. So in South America, in the Amazonian tribes, the taking of ayahuasca is part of the hunter-gatherer culture. And it's part of the warrior culture. Tribes engaging in conflict with one another and take the substances in order to maximize their strength and their ferocity and the courage. again, it depends on the set and setting, you see. So then Westerners come in, that's a completely different thing. We come from a completely different culture. We don't have a belief that the tribal culture all has a belief that nature is completely infused with spirit. The trees, the animals, the soil itself, the earth, everything is spirit, full of spirit. And you can communicate with it because we're also spirit. Western science says, well, no, there are these plants and there are these animals and da-da-da-da, and it's some material worldview. And what we're going through is a change in the material worldview. And the use of these mind-altering, mind-expanding substances is one small aspect of it. But it's an undoing of the stranglehold of old-world models of that are focused on just the material reality and the social political models that come from that, which is accumulation of wealth and, you know, material goods, and to the neglect of issues of lifestyle and human relationships and how do people relate to one another, and to the neglect of the environment and even the destruction of the wholesale environment. The indigenous people are looking around and saying, what are you guys doing? How can you be doing that? How can you be not sensitive as to, you know, what the frogs and the birds and the snakes and the rivers and are all saying to us? And of course, environmentalists know that and respond to that and make alliances with the indigenous people. But not all environmentalists are necessarily in favor of taking psychedelic drugs either. I mean, these are different parts of the culture, but there's a strong association between environmentalism and the psychedelic movement. I know for a fact that many of the people that were in psychedelic research in the 60s shifted over to environmental protection. They say modern American environmental movement also happened in the 60s, you know, with Rachel Carson writing Silent Spring, which was a consciousness-expanding experience. She didn't take any drugs whatsoever, but she asked herself the question, the spring is silent, the birds are not singing. Why are the birds not singing? And then she found out the reason was because there's all this chemical
DDT.
Stuff
yeah.
being yeah. emitted. So that's a consciousness-expanding question that she asked, you see, that led directly to new actions.
One of the things that struck me as a journalist interviewing people who had gone down to Brazil and Peru and had taken ayahuasca with shamans and people who were taking it here in the States and underground shamanic circles is they would talk about how the plants had some message, that the plants had some kind of an intention, either for them personally or it was Gaia, this earth mystical consciousness trying to save us from destroying ourselves with climate change or whatever. And I thought, well, that's a very kind of quaint, nice idea, but I can't believe that. I mean, how could a plant have consciousness or intention? And then I went down to Brazil and I drank this tea myself and I saw what they were talking about. And I'd done other psychedelic drugs and there was a different quality to the tea than there was to other substances I'd taken. It was like a guide leading me into my own brain to show me something. It was a qualitatively different experience. And then I came back to Northern California, had similar experiences, and, you know, stuff I was dealing with personally came up. So I don't know, you know, I still have trouble believing it rationally that a plant can have an intelligence or an intention somehow, but I understand what people are talking about now as a journalist who participated in some of this to try to understand
right.
it better. But I still don't know what's going on. I still can't explain it.
Right. You
know?
There's another edge to this, which I think is really critical, and that is that we're all coming to an agreement that we don't have a lot of time to fix some of our urgent problems in terms of how we're destroying the environment that sustains our lives and life around us. So this is looming in the background. So a lot of people are thinking that we have to try anything we can to get us to a better relationship with our environment, deeply held, deeply felt relationship. And there's very few modalities that you can point to that have the power and the effect that some of these materials do have, and able to bring about that kind of experience of connection with nature, with the living systems around you, etc. And so that's also looming in the background. That's the elephant in the room.
Well, that brings up a question that I wanted to talk to you guys about, which is the culture of the 1960s and 70s, and, you know, the idea that there are plant teachers, and the idea that, I mean, I have spoken to so many people and seen documentaries about the, like, Berkeley in the 60s, and this sense that you were creating a better world and fostering unity among all people and nature and all those things. It was so powerful. And yet, there was so much divisiveness. There was such a backlash against that culture. And we're now living in an Orwellian surveillance state, really, a military world, which is so much harsher than the world that people were protesting against in those days. And I mean, it's a paradox to me. Like, how do you understand that?
And you're right that in the 60s, all this psychedelic counterculture was associated with the New Left and the anti-war movement. And what's a little different now is it's not so much counterculture. It's getting more mainstream. And there isn't the same kind of divisiveness as mm-hmm. there was in the 60s. It'll be interesting to see what happens. There could be very easily be a new backlash, though. That's the thing. Some people are talking about this post-prohibition era already, where psychedelics are at least okay for medical purposes, maybe even for recreational purposes, like what's happening with marijuana.
Yeah.
Look at it state by state, medical marijuana, then legalization. Some people are seeing that, but there could very easily, I mean, Rick Doblin, who's the head of MAPS, which is just
whom we talked to on this
yeah,
show.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's told me, I interviewed him several times for my book, and he said his main fear is not that there's going to be bad reactions with research subjects or they can't raise the millions of dollars they need. His main fear is a new president, a new FDA commissioner, a back ramping up the drug right. war and shutting all this down, which could easily happen. But so far, that's not happening,
no.
actually. And people are, even the government seems in some ways be letting this emerge, or they know they can't control it. There is a different climate. There is a new openness on the part of the government to this.
They could easily, even the military.
Yeah.
In the military,
yeah.
where they're looking for help with PTSD, when, as Ralph mentioned,
yeah,
seven
no
GIs come back from theaters of war wanting to kill themselves a day and do. So, and many do but don't, but still, that's seven people a day.
Right.
Well, and there's a kind of multi or nonpartisan feel to the kinds of research that you're talking about, at least to some extent, certainly in comparison to that, as you say, connection among the new left, the anti-war movement, and the drug culture, which had such a divisive effect in the long run that there are people who still, you know, older people who politically define themselves in distinction to that movement and those people.
Yeah, as if the drugs were the cause of that, which is not true. They were not the cause of it.
They were just part of it, the whole mix.
They were part of that whole culture. Yeah. And I guess, I mean, when we talk about this question of healing ourselves, healing trauma, healing the world, having more of a connection to nature, and having that be part of the movement that we need in order to live in a sustainable manner on Earth and mitigate and reverse climate change and all of that, it seems to me that, I mean, we've always had enlightened people. We've always had bodhisattvas. We've always had spiritual seekers. We've also always had war and some version of evil mafias. And it seems like no matter how much ayahuasca and meditation we might introduce into the culture, the other side isn't going anywhere.
Well, I think the key in the door is the health benefits, the medical payoff. I mean, the military is looking there are minds have opened to things like psilocybin and MDMA because they have a big problem that it might solve. And it's interesting that some of the most promising medicines we have for a variety of very important problems are coming from psychedelic plants or other sacred plants. And this is changing. Healing trumps politics. So, I mean, you're seeing people now. Cannabis is a good example. Few people realize, because of this powerful war on drugs that went on for so many years, that cannabis was available in every American drugstore. Every major drug company had cannabis products. It was America's favorite analgesic, along with aspirin.
In the early 20th century.
Yes.
Yeah, see, I don't think it's true that healing trumps politics. I'm sorry. The opposite is true. Politics trumps healing, because here are these healthy, demonstrated, already healthy, in the treatment of trauma, medicines, and politically, people who suffer from trauma can't get them. They can participate in a small research project, but they can't go to a therapist healer and request this treatment, which has already been demonstrated already in the 60s, 40 years ago. was demonstrated.
Well, I meant it as a process. I mean,
it is a process. Absolutely,
I think we're going in that direction. I mean, cannabis. One of the things that has reintroduced cannabis as an acceptable material is, and I think legalization is a year or two away nationally, is that there is a host of problems, medical conditions that it really works for.
Yeah.
And now the discovery of CBD is just the beginning. CBD is the non-psychoactive part of the cannabis plant, which has shown efficacy in so many diseases that are really hard to deal with. And so that's just the beginning of medicines that come from cannabis and other materials that are targeted to certain conditions. The whole endocannabinoid system of the body has been a result of some of this early research.
You're on the board, Alan Bediner, of Project CBD. Tell us a little bit more. I mean, what are some of the health benefits you're referring to?
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, CBD is a really interesting intervention in the body because it actually deals with the genetic level of the genetic system of the body. So if you have a proclivity, for instance, towards a certain kinds of illness, whether it be cancer or diabetes or various other conditions, CBD, it's the way it works is it suppresses gene expression in those areas. So if you have that proclivity, it will fight within the body for homeostasis. So it's looking to balance all the systems. So if something's going out of balance, it will go into the genetic system and actually interfere with the expression of that gene.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it is. It's unlike any medicine we've ever had before.
I mean, that's something that people have been trying to engineer through scientific intervention for a long time. Why do you think, I mean, do you think we and other primates or maybe other mammals have been eating this throughout our history and it's just part of our sort of healing plant evolutionary process?
That's a significant speculation about the cannabis plants that, you know, that evolution is actually always a co-evolutionary process. And certain plants evolved and fungi evolved in conjunction with human nature and human culture and human civilization. Actually, it's kind of obvious once you think about it. How could it not, you see?
Yeah.
We use plants for food. We use plants for medicine of all kinds, not just psychedelic medicine, but medicines of all kinds for healing, for clothing, for shelter, for lifestyles, for building. So our lives are, as human beings, are inextricably interwoven with the plant kingdom, the mineral kingdom, the fungal kingdom, which is a separate kingdom, all the different worlds of nature and the different cultures of nature.
Don Lattin, you have this new book. It's not coming out yet. Maybe we'll get you back on the air when it does.
It'll be a few months at least.
Early next year. But it's called Changing Our Minds, The Reemergence of Psychedelics for Mental Health and Spiritual Growth. And you just alluded to the fact that in some ways we've come full circle since kind of the first round of psychedelics in the 60s and 70s, but to a kind of maybe less divisive, more open-minded place? I mean, how do you understand the point in history that we're at now with respect to these things?
Well, the funny thing, when you think about the psychedelic future of the medical use and the therapeutic use, and even the spiritual use of these substances, it looks like the past. I mean, a lot of the so-called discoveries that people are making in this research now, they were discovered in the whole first wave of this research in the 1950s and 1960s, before these substances were made illegal and made off limits to scientists. So it's really one of the researchers said that the motto for the research institute should be reinventing the wheel since 1993. I mean, because they've been basically confirming stuff that people already knew, scientists already knew. But because there's this need with PTSD or end of life anxiety and depression, so many people in the baby boom generation are now getting old and sick and dying. And these are people who experimented with these substances back in the 60s and 70s when they were young. One reason I'm calling the book Changing Our Minds, it's a double entendre, of course. The society seems to be changing our mind about the use and the benefit of these substances, which can also change our own minds individually. And it's a very hopeful and optimistic time. It's a little premature to start the post-prohibition party, as some people, I think, are doing. But there is a lot, and it's a rediscovery in a lot of ways of ancient wisdom and use of these substances, and also the scientific research that was done in the during the first wave.
Alan Bediner, what is your own hope for not only the legalization and wise use of these substances, but of the social change that they could bring?
The social change can't be separated, I don't think, from all the other benefits. I mean, we're seeing, obviously, when people take, for instance, MDMA and have an experience with that of compassion and caring about others and being more open-hearted, when the drug wears off, there's something left behind, which is your heart's a little more open. And that didn't go away with the drug fading away from your bloodstream or whatever. So there's definitely, I think the thing that people take home from these experiences is more compassion for others, for themselves, of open-heartedness and open-mindedness. Those are qualities I'd be happy with more of.
I loved what Houston Smith, who is a religious, still with us, he's very old now, but he's still with us. He was a religious studies scholar who worked a little bit with Timothy Leary and Ralph back at Harvard, and he says it's about altered traits, not altered states of consciousness. It's taking these altered states of mind and integrating them into our lives and becoming better people.
Right.
And that's where the rubber meets the road in this this whole realm, I think.
Mm-hmm. And I think, Ralph Messner, as you've pointed out in some of your books, there is a really profound reshaping of almost cosmology. I mean, we are in a world state right now where our kind of social structures and the materialist and kind of economic consumerist world that we live in is a reflection of a much more limited cosmology. And
yeah, our cosmology is expanding. It's like the 16th, 17th century with the so-called scientific revolution that broadened out, you know, and that scientists consider the vastness of the community and let us look, not just look to the church as the sole source of authority. And in a way, now the situation we're now is that mainstream science has become the establishment church that decides this is valid knowledge and this is not valid knowledge, and because this deals with the subjective. Science is under this delusion that they are the only ones who know about objective reality and who have methods to study objective reality. That's simply not true, because reality is not just subjective. It's objective and the subjective. You see, the Dalai Lama recently had, in one of his statements, he said, we need a first-person empiricism. The subjective realms and dimensions of everything can be studied with a scientific attitude too. And that was a former scientific tradition. And it is in the Eastern religions where meditation is a practice for exploring the subjective dimensions, mm-hmm. and how they relate to the objective. And that has to be taken into account. But our legal systems are woefully behind. But I think the two most important areas of application of these drugs are one in the treatment of trauma with substances like MDMA, which has to be done in the context of a protected and trained people. And the people who do the training, the therapy, have to be trained themselves and have experience with working with trauma. Not all therapists do. And then the other one is in the preparation for the end of life, which is a big taboo. And, you know, traumas are very common. But end of life is universal, 100%. It's something that none of us escape or can ameliorate or prevent, ultimately. We might prolong our lives, but ultimately the old guy is going to come and knock on our door, right? So.
And on that note, it's time to go.
Perfect.
Right. Ralph Metzner is a psychologist, writer, founder of the Green Earth Foundation, author of many books. Don Latin is an author and journalist. His forthcoming book from Synergetic Press is called, or will be called, Changing Our Minds, The Reemergence of Psychedelics for Mental Health and Spiritual Growth. Alan Bediner is an activist and writer, contributing editor to Tricycle Magazine and editor of the new edition of Zigzag Zen. And he's on the board of Project CBD. Gentlemen, thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Perfect.